Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at Irish literature over the past 320 years as we celebrate the publication of the monumental six-volume series Irish Literature in Transition, published by Cambridge University Press. Last week, for the October bank holiday weekend, we brought you our show on Irish foreign policy since independence, and 2 weeks ago we discussed the rise of democracy from the ancient world to the present time and explored the alliance of piracy in the 17th century and lots more in our second October book show. And if you want to listen back to either of these or any of our older shows, just go to our website newstalk.com or wherever you download your podcasts. In tonight's show, we're looking at Irish literature in transition from 1700 to the present day. A major new six-volume series published by Cambridge University Press explores the established literary landmarks that constitute Irish literary life over more than 300 years. So in tonight's show, we want to mark the publication of this monumental work by debating how Irish literature has evolved in this period, the turning points of real significance, and the writers and works that are central to the Irish literary experience. The series offers a new and dynamic version of literary history, and it's been praised for highlighting the significance of change as a lived, felt force. And tonight we'll discuss how this changes our understanding of Irish literature. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Claire Connolly is Professor of Modern English at University College Cork and is one of the two general editors of the six-volume series Irish Literature and Transition. And she's also the editor of the second volume, looking at the period 1780 to 1830. Professor Matthew Campbell is Professor of Modern Literature at York and is the editor of Volume 3, looking at the period 1830 to 1880. Professor Marjorie Howes lectures in English and Irish Studies at Boston College and is general editor of the six-volume series, as well as editor of Volume 4, looking at the period 1880 to 1940. Professor Eve Patton is director of the Trinity Long Room Hub Arts and Humanities Research Institute and lectures in the School of English at Trinity College Dublin. And she's the editor of Volume 5, looking at 1940 to 1980. Well, as I say, you are all very welcome. And Marjorie, I might start with you. And maybe big idea, what was the concept behind this six-volume series?
I think one of our big ideas was to show that literary history, the literary past, is not over. It's a moving target. And the way we understand how Irish literature has changed over the last several hundred years is actually shaped by other changes. So it's shaped by contemporary developments in scholarship and approach. In particular, I think we're moving away from a period in which, to some extent, scholarship was dominated by post-colonial models, and we're seeing the proliferation of quite a diverse range of contemporary scholarship. It's also, our sense of the literary past is also shaped by just how much material is now available. We're constantly bringing to light new archives, forgotten writers and works, obscure or out of print publications. And all that kind of recovery work shapes how the literary past looks. We also, I think, wanted to kind of rethink what a survey is. What does it mean to try and survey a field? And one of our objectives there was to map not what has happened in the past, but what's emerging, and kind of try and gesture towards what's coming on line for the future.
Claire, I'm curious why you decided to begin the series in 1700 and not, for example, say 1600 or 1534 or 1500?
It seems almost too obvious a point to make that the history of Irish literature is inseparable, not only from the history of English literature, but from the history of the English presence in Ireland and the repeated waves of Anglicisation. And the wave of Anglicisation that began in 1700 is a particularly intense, concentrated, central one in our kind of national story, I suppose. And it sees the beginning of the wholesale displacement of the Irish language, along with the proliferation of print and the whole world of print. And of course, that print is capturing not just kind of big shifts, but smaller changes in relationships. It's finding ways of putting Hiberno-English into print, kind of fun different forms with macaronic forms and, you know, linguistic play and things like that. New kinds of audiences are emerging across that century. Now, of course, it would be wrong of us to have a series called Irish Literature in Transition and not appreciate the earlier period as well. So the books actually begin with a look back at the earlier modern period and think about kind of turning points, ending points, starting points.
And my congratulations to the editors of the six volumes and to all of the contributors. It's an incredible collection of some of the finest writers and scholars on Irish literature. How big a challenge was it putting together all of these volumes and getting everyone to submit their essays in time? Marjorie, I might ask you, because I know from being involved in projects like this, it can sometimes be a nightmare. It's brilliant when it's published, but I'm sure there was a lot of stressful days when you were wondering whether you would get every essay in.
Yes, there were some tense moments, some periods of frenzied activity, and then punctuated by kind of waiting. But we have a wonderful set of contributors, and the series owes so much to them. They're really leading people in their field. So in a lot of ways, all we had to do was kind of point them at a chapter, and they would produce excellent work. We also, I think it was quite a challenge to think about how we wanted to design the volumes. There are lots of ways to carve up a survey, so you can do it by genre or theme or individual author. And we quite early on made a fairly difficult decision that we wanted a mix of those. And we did that because we were trying to show just how many different ways there are to organize a survey. In a sense, we were trying to gesture at the volumes that we didn't produce. I think we could easily, I mean, God forbid, but we could easily have put together six more volumes, given the ideas and the material we had. So that was a whole other kind of challenge as well, was the constraints of space and organization.
And Claire, there is an incredible amount of history in the volumes, because you see Irish literature in transition. You also see Ireland in transition over these years. And you see that very clearly in the six volumes, and even the sense of what Irish means in these periods.
Absolutely. And that's, I suppose, important, especially for the early volumes, where those issues are so much a kind of matter of live debate, I guess, from 1700 onwards. And so one thing we wanted was to try and invite readers to think about Irish literature not as a kind of, as it were, relatively inert container for this or that view of the Irish culture of the day, but rather as something that was kind of, you know, moving and flexing and changing as the culture itself was in transition. And we also wanted to try and capture some of the kind of relationships across time as well. So to go back to that, the volume that goes from 1700 to 1780, there's a wonderful chapter in that by Lasse Niavungula, who talks about translations up to the present of Merryman and of Queen Arthur Lera. Now, she doesn't actually get to take in Dearne Grifa's Ghost in the Throat and the even newer translation that we've had in these last few months that's come out. But we can sort of show how some of these lines kind of spread out and connect across time. And the sort of, I suppose we wanted to get at something of the kind of the rich tapestry of those connections across time.
And it's very clearly not a greatest hits of Irish literature. I think you made a very strong effort to make sure that it covers not just the major writers, but also a lot of the less well-known writers and maybe some that have been neglected.
That's exactly right, Patrick. And actually, that was one of the practical challenges that you're alluding to in putting the volume together. And I think maybe at the very start, when we were designing it, we might have overcorrected in relation to the lesser known writers. And we had to look at that and come back. And some early feedback we got on the volume suggested that there was more material in the books on Samuel White, the 18th century writer, than Samuel Beckett. And so, of course, that was an invitation to go back and consider what we were doing. So there was a lot of kind of careful thinking and arranging, and I'm sure by no means perfect either. But we did our best to try and kind of map these relationships. And I guess in the case of my own volume, I go from 1780 to 1830, we were able to draw on different levels of existing scholarship as well. So I have a chapter on Maria Edgeworth by James Chandler, very sophisticated chapter that thinks about Edgeworth as a kind of realist, what she takes from Austen, what George Eliot takes from her, you know, those kinds of questions. And that's possible because we have such a wealth of existing scholarship on Edgeworth now that nobody needs to write a sort of introductory chapter to her. But yet there are other authors who do need that kind of introductory work. And so, again, we were trying to kind of layer in and out these different approaches to different writers.
Matt, your volume goes from 1830 to 1880, and there are 17 wonderful essays in it. I wonder, did you have an idea starting off who you wanted in the volume, or was it that you had a sense of the shape of the book and that you had an idea of the different themes and you looked for scholars who would fit into that?
Very good question, indeed, because I think that the first idea that you would have is about what it is that you need to cover, the kind of coverage that you need, particularly to do the 19th century, because it's so diverse. So you had an idea, first of all, the diversity of the period. And then, of course, you've always got people in mind who you know are the experts in a particular field, and you really want to get them in your book. But those were both experienced critics, experienced scholars, but also younger scholars, people who've discovered things really very, very recently and are able to bring a completely fresh view to the period.
And there's a very interesting chapter on Newman's Irish University, for example, by Colin Barr, and James Quinn on Young Ireland and the politics, and also what's going on in terms of Irish society and even education. Economics comes into it as well. And then, of course, the shadow of the famine, that you get a real sense of as I said before, Ireland in transition in this period.
Yes, I mean, that is very much the case. History writing, as you know, Patrick, is writing. And there are some great writers who were also historians. And in a figure like something like Thomas Davis would be the most famous example of this, somebody who actually counseled the importance for writing history as a crucial part of establishing an Irish national consciousness. And that notion of history writing itself was very, very important. But of course, what is also going on there at the same time is to attempt to replace a kind of a writing in English for the loss of the writing in Irish, which was gradually disappearing off the streets of the cities, and then gradually, of course, disappearing due to the famine from the countryside as well. So English writing, in a way, come along and to fulfill a gap or a loss that was coming into the culture, come on, something that's marked in the history of emigration and of the diaspora, but also indeed the history of the language and the language shift for the most population of Ireland.
Eve, your volume begins in 1940, and as you show in the introduction, there's a very good reason for starting in 1940, because you have some writers, even at the time, almost marking that as a crucial turning point.
Indeed, Patrick. Yeah, there's lots of comments about 1940 as a kind of partition in itself between an older version of Revival Ireland and then this strange period after the Second World War, when I think a lot of people have preconceptions and expectations that Ireland somehow went to sleep during this time. Neutrality, the emergency, have created a legacy, I think, that led to ideas that Ireland was somehow disconnected from the intellectual and the great social upheavals in the rest of Europe. And one of the things I wanted to show with this volume was, in fact, there was a lot of connection. There was a lot of active engagement with the various forces and changes that had been galvanized by the Second World War. So I was really trying to use this volume to work against those expectations that there would simply be a stagnation, that one writer has talked about this as the flat landscape period in Irish writing. And I was very concerned to show that's not the case. This is a volatile period, full of internal contradictions, full of excitements, and full of a huge variety of genres that do various different things.
And even looking at the way you divided it thematically, it seems that there are many different things in transition. There are ideologies, genres, identities, even criticism itself is in transition.
Criticism is very exciting in this period. To me, this is when we begin to see a school of Irish literary criticism really beginning to come to maturity and to come to self-consciousness. And this is when you have the great lions of Sean O'Fallon and Frank O'Connor, for example, beginning to write essays that say, well, what is our literary condition? What does it mean to write Irish literature? And not perhaps answering that question, but at least evolving it. So all the journals that we see and the critical material that we see emerging in this period begins to become a kind of school. And that's very exciting because it opens up the volume to questions that for me were very much about genre. This is a volume that tries not just to track poetry and the novel and theatre, but also to look, for example, at the impact of literary biography. Biography is something that, as you know, Patrick, as a historian, is very often what helps the nation build its sense of identity. So in this timetable that I was looking at, I was looking at biography, and I was also trying to excavate kinds of literature that were, let's say, not part of a high Irish canon, not written in the tradition of a Yeatsian school. So to look to what we think of as middlebrow novels, very often these are written by women, but not necessarily. They might be romances, thrillers, historical novels, published in paperback, but absolutely flooding the country in the middle decades of the 20th century. And as Marjorie was saying earlier, because we've now got such great databases and archives of this kind of material, we have a very different landscape critically to look at, and we can go and see what Walter Macken was writing or what Dorothy McArdle was writing and see these works that have really been overlooked, I think, in understanding an Irish canon and the impact of Irish criticism.
Marjorie, I wonder, did it become more difficult for the people dealing with the later period and even going into the 21st century? Is it sometimes easier to look at the writers when you have the benefit of a couple of centuries distance, whereas it might be more difficult to spot and identify who are going to be the major writers or the major pieces of literature when they're right on our doorstep?
Yeah, on the one hand, I think that's quite true. And on the other hand, my experience with my own volume was kind of threw up a different kind of challenge because I did the period 1880 to 1940. It's arguably the most famous period in Irish literary history. It's been the subject of a huge amount of scholarship. So on one level, it's a period that we think we know, but we've also come to know it in particular ways that I was trying to get out from under to some extent. It's also, my period was a period where, as you were saying, yes, there are established literary giants like Yeats and Joyce, that come from that period. While it's, you know, it's clear they're in the canon, right? And it's not as so clear with more contemporary work who's going to achieve that status. The challenge for the essays on, say, Yeats and Joyce in my volume was I wanted essays that would resist some of the ways that those figures have shaped the way we see them. In other words, I wanted essays that would not necessarily adopt the concepts and vocabularies that Yeats and Joyce would offer them about their own work or about the period. So one example here would be Joe Valente's essay on Yeats, which reads his politics not using terms that Yeats would give him, but through disability studies, through concepts of things like ableism or compulsory able-bodiedness. And this gives us a whole new way of understanding Yeats's representations of things like bodily perfection, beauty, bodily decrepitude, right? Things we think we know well about Yeats. And yet they look quite different read through this approach. So the periods that we know well offer certain kinds of challenges, and they're different from the challenges of the more contemporary eras when canons are not quite as sorted out.
So even though you had Joyce and, as you say, Yeats and Synge and Wilde, by looking at it from a different perspective, you're able to show how these figures themselves were also in transition.
Yes, the transitions and how we currently see them. Another example would be the Joyce chapter, which is by Enda Duffy. We're accustomed to thinking about Joyce as a Dublin writer, somebody who was preoccupied with representing Dublin. And Duffy's argument is that no, actually, Joyce was interested in exploring the particular kind of semi-urban space that is a suburb, because at the historical moment when Joyce is writing, Dublin's population is growing and suburbs are being built. And he shows Joyce kind of meditating on certain kinds of, say, class structures that characterize suburbs in particular. So that's another example of kind of rewriting a writer that we thought we knew well, based on the massive amounts of scholarship.
So, Claire, does that go back to then the overall title of Irish Literature in Transition, that it's an attempt to show by use of the word transition that this is a dynamic process, that things are changing, that you can't look at these as just being fixed in time?
That's right. And of course, we started thinking about the books were published in the spring. We started to think about talking about them and beginning to launch them and so on, just in the immediate aftermath of our general election, which seemed to deliver kind of an unprecedented set of political results in Ireland. We were to go on into February and March and discover that yet greater change could come, and we could be faced with unknowable experiences. So there's, if we ever would have been foolish enough to think that we were sort of drawing a line under literary history, we've certainly been disabused of that. But in fact, what we were trying to do all along really was to kind of pull out these threads and, like I say, sort of loosen the tapestry of connections between and across the centuries, so that other people can pick up the threads and kind of pull them in different ways, make other sorts of connections. So we hope that there are new discoveries in the books, and that there's even new discoveries about the period 1980 to 2020 as well. There's new discoveries all through. But there's also kind of new ways of writing and thinking and talking, all contributing to, you know, the great richness of the kind of critical culture we have around Irish literature.
Well, we're talking history, and tonight we're celebrating the publication of the monumental 6-volume series, Irish Literature in Transition. It's published by Cambridge University Press. They've done an absolutely beautiful job. And I'm talking tonight to 4 of the editors, and 2 of them, of course, are the overall general editors of the series as well. And we'll be back after this break. We'll be talking about some of the writers, some of the works, and some of these transitions. So stay with us here on News Talk.
Talking history on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Tonight we are celebrating the publication of the monumental 6-volume series, Irish Literature in Transition, published by Cambridge University Press, by talking to the editors about what it was like putting the volumes together and what exactly was in transition between 1700 and the year 2020. I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Claire Connolly, Professor Matthew Campbell, Professor Marjorie Howes, and Professor Eve Patton. Eve, going back to your volume, volume 5, can I ask you about geography? Because it's not just Irish literature happening on the island.
That's right. This was one of the big challenges of the 1940 to 1980 period, is that you really don't see Irish writing staying neatly within the borders of Irish geography, let's say. It's very, very mobile. And of course, all across the period we're talking about, in all 6 volumes, we have Irish writers who are literary exiles, who are somewhere else, Joyce being perhaps the most famous example. But I think after 1940, we see the huge expansion of an Irish diaspora, which is very active in writing about its own experience. And this gets translated into a very healthy coterie in, let's say, Irish America, that's working in the journals and publishing houses there, and writers such as Maeve Brennan and Frank O'Hara coming through to shape a kind of literature which is responding to both places. It's looking at the new environment, the excitement of Chicago or New York, but it's also looking back to what has been left behind. So you get a very interesting bifocalism coming into the literature. Even more challenging, I think, is to really have a forensic look at Ireland's literary relations with England in this period. Because, of course, we're looking at Irish writers who are writing, again, very productively in Liverpool or Coventry or London, and again, writing about their experiences of leaving home and making new communities for themselves. But added to that, and really this was my responsibility to try and give a full picture of this period, we have vast numbers of Irish writers being published in Britain. And it's in this period, in the late 40s, 1950s through to the 60s, that you really see the effects of the big publishing houses like Faber and Penguin circulating and recirculating Irish writing for a much bigger readership than it would have received at home. And I think some of the essays in this volume pay very interesting attention to how Irish writing was produced and published and packaged and reprinted outside the island itself.
And Eve, you also in the volume explore a lot of the big pressure points over this period. You have the Troubles breaking out. And then even within Southern Ireland, you have problems with censorship, and you have the writings of John McGarren exploring some of the things that are going on underneath the surface. And like it's a very busy time in terms of how Ireland itself is changing and how the island is changing.
Yes, and in fact, one of the exciting things and the encouraging things is to see just how good Irish writers were in this period at challenging the edicts of the state, whether it's fighting, as John McGahan did repeatedly and very inventively, against the censorship board and the censorship of publications regime, or whether it's the explosion, as I think of it, in a very great tradition of Irish satire in this period. So Flann O'Brien really leading the pack, but other figures such as Dennis Devlin and, of course, Patrick Kavanagh, working to really upset and destabilize the idea of an authoritarian, paternalistic control over the imagination. So in many ways, the sense of a repression of Ireland and Irish identity in this period is met with this burst of energy to resist that pressure. And that's so creative.
And Rosie Lavin, for example, has a brilliant chapter on violence, politics and the poetry of the Troubles.
Yes, and of course, this was always, in many ways, the end point that this volume had to get to. How do we think about the Troubles without it really not paying tribute to everything that has come before? It's very often seen as another rupture, that the Troubles and the writers of the Troubles came from nowhere. But of course, they in turn were looking back to previous generations. And I think one of the great things that Rosie is able to do is to really patch together again the lines of influence and continuity from the 1950s, say, right the way through to the 1970s.
I wonder, did you have to make sacrifices when you were putting the volume together? Were there writers that you had to maybe leave out just because there wasn't enough space, or because there wasn't a scholar working in the area? And were there limits just because you can't cover everything?
You can't cover everything. We had a go. There's endless material that I would love to have included. I think at least some of the essays in here begin to carve out new territory in how we think about Irish writing. So in some ways they point to the need for more volumes in the future. There's a terrific piece, for example, on the influence of secondary education on perceptions of Irish literature. So in short, how the evolutions of the Leaving Certificate and the way that English literature was taught in schools created the mindset of a contemporary generation of writers who grew up under that kind of training. And this is something we really haven't looked at before. And it's even looking at the Leaving Certificate, believe it or not, as a sounding board as to at what point people start to think about the need to teach Irish literature in schools alongside the Wordsworths and Shakespeare's. So this is the kind of area that I think the volume begins to look at, but there's a lot more to be done.
And there are some wonderful chapters on that towards the end of the volume as well, even looking at things like the curriculum and the creation of the Irish literary canon. And is that a good thing when you have an Irish literary canon, or should it always be flexible and changing?
It is always flexible and changing. And I think what Sean Richards, who authored the chapter on the formation of a literary canon, looks at are the constant processes of movement where you might get, for example, American criticism and formalist criticism holding sway for a long period of time over Irish writing, over Joyce and over Beckett. And then it comes back home again. And Irish critics begin to look in much more historicist terms at these writers. So in a way, you always have a kind of recalibration of the canon going on. And one of the things I was keen to do was to track that in this period and be self-conscious about it.
Matt, in your volume on the 19th century, geography also features strongly, and there's a whole section on the globalising Irish, and it's clear that Irish literature is having an impact, and it's also, you also have the writers travelling far and wide.
Indeed, Patrick, one of the major features of being Irish is that you don't live in Ireland, and so many Irish people have been scattered across the world. And the 19th century, I mean, Eve's just been talking about the 1940s, 1950s being an extraordinary period for Irish emigration, and again, indeed, into the 1980s. But the centre of the middle of the 19th century is, of course, the great time of Irish emigration. I think that the population, you could correct me as a historian, but I think the population of Ireland went from about 8 million in 1800 down to less than 5 million by 1900. Now, a lot of that is to do with the great catastrophe of the famine in the middle of that, but also that emigration had been continuing all the way through the 19th century, both to England, to the USA, to Australia, sometimes not necessarily for good reasons, and of course, across the British Empire, because many Irish people were working as servants of the empire in India, most particularly.
And as you say there, the famine, because that does loom large. And is that a cataclysm that disrupts everything, or how does that affect Irish literature?
Eve has just mentioned the notion of the rupture, maybe of 1969, of the troubles. That, and I think that without being sentimental about that, what the troubles had occasioned in a certain way was a great sense of an imagination under pressure, of a response from the writers at that particular time to what it was, the condition that they were going through. As Derek Mahan said, a good poem is a paradigm of good politics. Now, it is actually quite difficult to find that same thing happening in the middle of the 19th century, because the catastrophe was just so great, and because the rapid depopulation was so great, and also indeed because of the language. It took the language with it as well. So it's a different kind of a rupture. For many, many years, decades of Irish history writing or writing about Irish literature, it has been thought of as a kind of an absence, something which has been missing from the Irish story, the inability to write a story or write about a story which was just so overwhelming. But I think that the course of the 19th century shows the imagination recollecting itself after that extraordinary catastrophe. And by the end of the 19th century, then you've got, obviously, the growth of figures like Wilde and Shaw, albeit working and living in London, or indeed the Irish-American novelists writing across America, so that there's something which is coming out from this sense of a great uprooting and then a rerooting again in the Irish soil.
One writer who features prominently in your own introduction is Speranza, you know, maybe popularly known as the mother of Oscar Wilde, but yeah, very significant in her own right. And I hadn't realised quite how politically engaged and involved she was in the 1840s.
Indeed, she is supposed to have written the Die Is Cast editorial in The Nation, or the United Irishman, as it became in the late 1840s, the editorial which caused the suppression of the newspaper and indeed the imprisoning of the leaders of Young Ireland. As a woman, she was not herself imprisoned, and the various ways were attempted to try to stop that happening to her. But she had an extraordinary career subsequent to that. And of course, whenever her son was in trouble and was after losing his libel case, and then indeed after losing the second case against him, and whenever he was going to run away to France, she told him, stay and fight. she certainly was an extraordinary firebrand.
And it's interesting, sometimes she published under a female name, sometimes under a male name. And was there a prejudice against writings by a female author? Or I see there's an essay on the rise of the woman writer. And of course, it's coming after a period when you had great writers like Mariah Edgeworth and so on. But was gender featuring much?
Well, the gender, of course, many British writers at the time British woman writers at the time wrote under pen names. Even the Bronte sisters initially published as the Bell brothers in the 1840s. So it was quite a common way of doing it. But of course, all of the writers of the nation and so many people who wrote across the British periodical press wrote under pseudonyms as well. There was continuously this kind of sense of play of who exactly the writer was, who the writer spoke for, and in what person the writer spoke, which of course that's something that's the broader sense of Victorian literature as well too. The gender question is very interesting because so many of the writers of the nation were these young women, Eva of the nation, Mary of the nation, these young women who wrote quite frequently nationalist, quite frequently Catholic confessional poetry. And I think it's important if we rewrite the story of the 19th century, we've got to realize that there was a strong sense of a Catholicism writing itself out in certain ways, where the mainstream British Victorian literature we often think as of a Protestant or a nonconformist literature.
Marjorie, I think the volumes are very successful as works of recovery as well, at looking at neglected writers and maybe digging up some of the parts of their work that have been ignored and forgotten about for so long. And they fit in very nicely alongside the more famous and established writers.
Yes. And there were a number of issues that I had to consider and that our authors had to consider. I'll turn to the example of Vera Kralkamp's essay in my volume on the Ascendancy novel, where one thing she is doing is expanding what counts as part of that genre. So she brings in popular fiction, works by Catholic writers, works that engage with World War I. So we get a kind of expanded sense of the genre. To go back to what Matt was saying, many of those writers were women writers. And in fact, large numbers of them actually made their livings. They were professional writers making a living with their writing. But the other thing that essay does is to consider the kind of implications and limits of recovery work, basically by asking the question, is absolutely everything worth recovering? And this goes back also to what Eve was talking about in terms of the canon. The canon will always be flexible. Canons will always be changing. But it is difficult to get away from canons altogether. We will always have some kind of a canon. So it's a real balancing act, performing certain kinds of recovery work while not completely abandoning questions of quality and judgment and so on. Another example of a sort of recovery work would be Lauren Arrington's essay on Augusta Gregory, who was already a well-known figure, but she was basically known as a kind of theater manager and patron of people like Yeats. And Arrington is kind of bringing out neglected aspects of her, in particular, some of her thinking on kind of gender and politics. So that's a different kind of recovery work. I would also say that other kinds of recovery work alter our sense of the existing literary landscape. And here I'm thinking of something like Paige Reynolds' essay in my volume, where she takes the kind of conventional opposition between the traditionalism of the Abbey Theater and the experimentalism of the Gate, and shows that if we concentrate on some more neglected women writers, that contrast is actually somewhat undone, and different kinds of patterns will emerge. So recovery work has all kinds of interesting results and implications depending on exactly what is being recovered.
Very good. And Claire, the very term Irish literature, is that something that was always used, or can you even date when that became part of the discussion as well?
Yeah, that's a curious one, Patrick. So in and around the period that we think of as the Romantic period, sort of roughly the 1780s up to the 1830s, people are starting to ask questions about that term and think about how to use it. So Thomas Crofton Croker, you know, says, well, obviously this is a term that should be reserved only for writing in the Irish language. A number of other people say that as well. Irish literature can only mean that. But then he goes on to say, and he says the problem with that is that the people who admire it, he says, are either ignorant and illiterate. So, you know, the mass of the people, the peasantry, or they're so sort of, you know, learned and boring and dull that they can't explain to the rest of us. So they're the people who are salvaging the Gaelic manuscripts and trying to kind of reconstruct what they're beginning to think about as a lost tradition. And then you go into the 1830s and 40s, and indeed in The Nation, as Matt was talking about, you have John Mitchell, for example, you know, playing around with a whole bunch of terms. He says native literature, Celtic literature. Mitchell runs through an amazing roll call of everyone we think of as an Irish writer now, you know, Swift, Edgeworth, Moore, and so on, and says, they're all authors, he says, but they're not what we call national authors. So that sort of debate around what Irish literature would mean is really kind of alive. And it's important for us to look back on, I think, because, again, there's this idea that there's this danger that we might sort of think of the term as relatively inert and just sort of sitting there at the top of school syllabi and university courses and so on, when in fact it's kind of contested and fought over.
And Claire, is the term Anglo-Irish literature still used, or is that seen as maybe too narrow, or that it separates it from other types of Irish literature?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. It tends not to be used now, and indeed partly because there was a feeling that it may have, as it were, segregated off Protestant writers from Catholic ones, for example. But one of the good things about the term when it was in use is it preserved that sense of a kind of division and conflict across the centuries of Irish literature. So I'm always interested, for example, by the way that my colleagues in Wales talk about Welsh writing in English. That's the term they use. Anglo-Welsh has also gone out of fashion there. But we've tended to use Irish literature now to, you know, to cover the range. And across the volumes in the series, we've tried to kind of maintain a sense of that contest, and to keep an eye on the relationship of an emerging English writing, Irish writing in English, to the Irish writing that it's also coexisting beside, or the speech of the people, of course, as well.
And in your volume, it's very clear that even though you have dominant figures like Maria Edgeworth and Thomas Moore, that actually the first part of the 19th century, and it's a lot more than those writers, and that there's an awful lot more going on in terms of Irish literature.
Exactly. And there's this kind of dynamic relationship. And I suppose one of the things I tried to do in the introduction that I wrote as well was to try and tell the story of the emergence of something that we can identify and name as Irish literature, and then we can anthologize it and debate about it and have arguments about it. I tried to do it through kind of a few case studies. So I took the three writers that we now think of as the most important writers of those decades, Maria Edgeworth, Sidney Owenson, Lady Morgan, and Thomas Moore. And I placed them all in 1803, which I don't have to tell you, Patrick, is a resonant political date, and one that often kind of crosses between literature and history. And when I placed them all just there in 1803 and to see what they were all up to, you know, none of them are doing what we would call writing Irish literature. They're all doing different things. They're trying to think about Moore and Owenson are thinking about how to make a living. There's a whole kind of emergence of the role of the professional writer that's important for those decades as well. And Moore is particularly interesting because he both is kind of experimenting with patronage, the older 18th century way of having a well-to-do patron who would encourage your literary labours. He sort of partly belongs to that world, but he's also moving into the kind of newer world of commercial writing. And Edgeworth is different because she's landed and she doesn't need the money that the books are making for. It becomes useful later for the estate, but it's not her kind of main purpose. So across those three writers, you can see them all in different places with different kind of financial motivations and kind of inching towards something that later now we can definitely look back on and say, yes, they are Irish writers.
And Eve, I'll give a final question to you. If we were to have a retrospective in 10 years' time on this series, what would you like it to have achieved? Would you like it to be cited regularly by students and scholars? Would you like it to have encouraged people to think differently about Irish literature over these years? Would you like it to have kick-started different debates? What does success look like for you?
I think Claire has said it very well. We want people to argue and keep arguing, because nothing about Irish writing is fixed knowledge. It's constantly in transition. And our understanding of what Irish writing is in transition all the time. So in 10 years' time, I hope people are still arguing about it.
Very good. Well, maybe we might come back then and do another show on it. Well, my congratulations to the editors and to all of the contributors. An absolutely brilliant series published in 6 volumes by Cambridge University Press. It's called Irish Literature in Transition and goes from 1700 to 2020. My thanks to my brilliant panel tonight, Professor Claire Connolly, Professor Matthew Campbell, Professor Marjorie Howes and Professor Eve Patton. That does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cahill, my producer, and Peter Malloy on sound. Next week we'll be looking at the life and work of Copernicus, and we'll be discovering how he changed forever the way we view our place in the universe. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.
Talking History on News Talk.